Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Good evening and welcome to tonight's Commonwealth Club program, Silicon Valley, brought to you from the Oshman Family JCC in Palo Alto. My name is Allison Van Diggelen. It's my pleasure to introduce Carly Fiorina. Carly is the former CEO of Hewlett-Packard and chair of Good 360, the world's largest product philanthropic organization. Throughout her career, she's held executive positions at AT&T and Lucent and made history when she became the first woman to lead a Fortune 20 company. In 2010, Carly ran for Senate and has served as an advisor to Republican presidential candidates John McCain and Mitt Romney. She's a regular commentator for CNBC and serves on a number of boards for various international, academic, business, and government organizations. Carly receives her Bachelor of Arts from Stanford University, an MBA from the University of Maryland, and a Master of Science in Management from the MIT Sloan School of Management. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Carly Fiorina.
Thank you and good evening. It's great to be with you and happy spring, finally. I want to start this evening, perhaps appropriately, given that we are in Silicon Valley, by talking about technology. And then I'd like to talk a little bit about what I believe is the state of our economy and what we need to do to ensure our competitiveness in the 21st century. This is, of course, where so much of technology is born. But I think it's useful sometimes to step back and realize what technology is doing. It is true that we are now living in a time in history when, for the first time in human history, any person, anywhere, has access to any piece of information on any device. That's stunning, actually. Now, of course, people have to have the means to buy the device. There has to be the infrastructure in place. And sadly, not everyone has access to the technology. But it is possible for any person anywhere to gain access to any piece of information on any device at any time. That is historic. It is more than historic. It is the first time in human history that individuals have been empowered in this way. The consequences are, of course, profound. It means that there are so many more possibilities for individuals, no matter where they are in the world. It means that institutions are, whether they like to be or not, more transparent and therefore more accountable. One of the reasons I think that so many people are losing so much trust in so many different institutions is because we actually know more about them. We know things about them that we never knew before. Maybe institutions are more corrupt now than they used to be, but maybe it is also true that we just see it in a way we never saw it before. So an individual is empowered. There is far more transparency, which leads to more accountability. And there's one other thing that technology does, and this is why I want to start with it. Technology renders large, centralized bureaucracies increasingly incompetent, no matter how powerful they are. Technology renders centralized bureaucracies increasingly incompetent, no matter where they are, no matter what they do. Why do I say that? Because think about how a bureaucracy works. And this isn't a political comment, it's a technology comment. Think about how a bureaucracy works. I don't care whether it's a corporate bureaucracy or a government bureaucracy or a church bureaucracy, it doesn't matter. How does a bureaucracy work? Well, in a bureaucracy you have hierarchical decision making, And in hierarchical decision-making, information flows up and decisions flow down. In an era where information is awash, where anybody can gain access to any piece of information at any time for any purpose, that process, that decision-making process, is increasingly slow in a world characterized by very rapid information exchange and very rapid change. And it is increasingly unable to deal with the rapidity of change, the complexity of the problems. A centralized bureaucracy simply can't react quickly enough. And that's why you see now in the 21st century, you see companies decentralizing decision making. You see institutions of all kinds trying to put more and more information in the hands of people who are having to make decisions every day rather than drive decision making to the top. I start with that because if we think about the state of California, if we think about the state of our nation, if we think about the state of the world, we need to think about all of those things in the context of individuals who are increasingly powerful and institutions which are increasingly incompetent. Not because the people are bad, but because the decision-making process itself is increasingly challenged. What's going on in our economy? You know, we have the stock market at record highs. We have very good signs in some ways. Certainly there are areas of California that are coming back. Silicon Valley is back. You see home prices coming back. You see unemployment levels basically falling. So there are some good signs. On the other hand, I think it's fair to say that everyone agrees the economy is underperforming its potential. When you have growth rates of somewhere between 1 and 2%, we're not performing at the level we should be. And it's important to remember that we have still, in this country, 12.3 million Americans who are unemployed. We have 48 million Americans on food stamps. We have lost 6.4 million full-time jobs in the last 5 to 6 years. We have 8 million Americans working part-time who want to be working full-time. We have 10 million Americans who have dropped out of the workforce altogether. We have 1 in 6 Americans living in poverty. And I was just reading an article this morning which underline the fact that even here in Silicon Valley, even here in the Bay Area, one of the wealthiest, most blessed regions in the world, 20% of Bay Area residents live at subsistence level or lower. Subsistence level is $22,000 a year for a family of four. Imagine trying to live on that in this area. So 20% of the population here in the Bay Area lives at subsistence level or below. By any measure, our economy is underperforming when we have those kinds of statistics. So the question is why? The question is why? And I think the facts are that we have four structural problems in our economy today, and we must deal with them. I think, frankly, somewhat radical reform is necessary to deal with them, all in the context of institutions that are increasingly unable to deal with the problems before us. And I share, I think, most Americans' frustration with our political processes' inability to come to closure on many of these issues. So what are these four structural problems? Well, let me begin with an anecdote. There was a survey done by the Washington Post relatively recently that asked small businesses kind of where they thought things were. 70% of small businesses said that they felt government was hostile to them. Not neutral, hostile. Now, why does that matter? Why does that matter? Because small business is the engine of growth in our economy. It always has been. You know, when someone introduces me, you know, the resume sounds impressive. I graduated from Stanford University with a degree in medieval history and philosophy in the middle of a recession. I went to law school. I hated it. I dropped out. Where did I go to get employed? Where most people go. I went to a small business. I went to a little 9-person firm 3 miles down the road on El Camino, close to El Camino. It is where virtually all Americans get their start. Small businesses, small and new businesses, employ over half the people in this country. Small and new businesses create over 2/3 of the new jobs in this country. If you look at where immigrants and minorities get their start, it is in small businesses. Whether it wave after wave after wave of immigrants have started in small businesses, women frequently end up employed in small businesses. African Americans, Hispanic Americans, Asian Americans. Small business is the first rung, the first handhold on the rung of the dream of the America. How do you build a better life for yourself and your family? You start in a small business. And I'm not talking about the exciting businesses like Hewlett and Packard that started in a garage, or Google. I mean, those are exciting businesses and they create a lot of jobs and they're incredibly important. But I am also talking about the deli on the corner, the dry cleaner, the taqueria. I mean, just basic businesses that are the foundation of any community. It's not just that small business and entrepreneurs are the engine of growth in our economy. They're also the engine of innovation. So small and new businesses generate patents at a rate of 11 times large businesses. When I was at Hewlett Packard, we were very proud to be generating 11 patents a day by the end of my tenure. That was fantastic. But imagine small businesses in general are generating at 11 times that rate. So little businesses, wherever they are how people get their start in this country. They are the job creators in this country. They are the innovation engine in this country. So when small businesses think the environment is hostile to them, we have a problem. Here's another problem we have. More small businesses are failing and fewer are starting right now than at any time in the last 40 years. Why? Why is that? Well, if you talk to small business owners, what you'll hear is, sort of reflected in that survey, it's just too hard. It's just too hard. And there isn't enough encouraging me to take a risk. Imagine you're a small business owner, an entrepreneur, and you're thinking about starting a business. You have to deal with a 27,000-page tax code. Forget whether you think rates are too high or too low. Forget any of that. We have a 27,000-page tax code today, a federal tax code. Why? Because the tax code was, federal tax code was designed by a lot of politicians, lobbied by a lot of big companies. The tax code is designed to help big companies. Big companies know how to lobby to get certain things in the tax code, loopholes, certain extra measures. That level of complexity a big company like Hewlett-Packard can deal with. You know, you hire lawyers and accountants and lobbyists. A small business can't deal with it. And regardless of party, regardless of political persuasion, the reality is also that bureaucrats in Washington do things. And one of the things they do is write rules, write regulations. The reality is that every year, regardless of party, hundreds of new regulations hit the books, and none are ever repealed. So think about that. Think about the thicket of complexity that an entrepreneur has to deal with. I fear that we are literally over time choking the life out of the engine of growth in our economy. And you know, you can say that every single provision in the tax code made sense as an individual. You can say that every single regulation that's put on the books makes sense individually. But when you get all of this piled on top and on top and on top, you have a thicket of complexity that is becoming harder and harder to navigate. And so people stop trying. More small businesses are failing and fewer are starting now than at any time in the last 40 years. So I believe while we are now maybe beginning to engage in a debate about tax reform, we need to be thinking about radically simple tax reform. My personal view is we should lower every rate and close every loophole. But forget whatever your personal views are about what tax rates should be. I think a fundamental goal now needs to be, if we care about encouraging entrepreneurship, about making it easier for small business owners to start and stay in business, about convincing small business owners and entrepreneurs, no, the government isn't hostile to you. The government is there to help you get started, to encourage you to put your money at risk and build something for yourself and your family and for others. We need a tax code and a regulatory structure that is vastly simpler. I said that I thought Washington, D.C., big government works for big labor and big business. And that's fact. Big government works for people who are big enough with enough resources to navigate big government. But if you're a little entrepreneur somewhere, you don't have the resources to navigate it. I think we need a wholesale mindset shift in Washington. And this isn't a partisan comment, a wholesale mindset shift in Washington that says, what is it that the government is here to do? The government is not here to make every decision. We can't. Technology renders us incompetent to make every decision. What we're here to do is create an environment in which entrepreneurs can thrive because they represent the engine of growth and innovation in this country. And for entrepreneurs and small business owners to thrive, we need to vastly simplify the morass that they have to get through. So that's one structural issue that I think we need to deal with. And I hope very much, although I must say I'm somewhat pessimistic, that in all of the debate about what we should do with sequester and debt and deficit, that somewhere in that debate, we will actually have a real conversation about a radical simplification of our tax code and a relook at our regulatory regime. I believe every single regulation should be looked at, every single one. And we should actually get rid of a lot that don't make sense. Second structural thing in this country, and this will not be a surprise to you, we need, in my opinion, very fundamental education reform. Education is a popular topic. Obviously, we've been talking about it a long time, and we've been spending actually a lot of money on it. It's interesting to note that as a nation, we spend more per pupil than every other nation in the world but one. And yet, the quality of our output continues to deteriorate. Here in California as a state continues to spend more money per pupil than 49 out of 50 states. And yet, our results are at the very bottom of the pile. So actually, it turns out, this is certainly true in business, it turns out it's true in education as well. It's not actually not all about how much money you spend. It's about what are you spending it on and where are you spending it and how are you spending it. The budget of the Department of Education has increased virtually every year for 40 years, and the quality of our education continues to deteriorate. So clearly there isn't a direct link between the amount of money we spend and the quality of the result that we get. What's the thing that makes the most difference to students? Everyone agrees. What's the thing that makes the single biggest difference to the quality of a child's education? A teacher. A teacher. The quality of our teachers. Many people have many different opinions about this. My own view is that the most important thing we can do now is make sure that every parent has a real choice and every child has a real chance. I don't know how many of you watched the teacher strike that went on in Chicago, but in the middle of that strike, whosever side you were on, it doesn't matter. In the middle of that strike, the head of the teachers union said, you know, we really can't be held accountable for results because so many of our children come from poor and distressed family situations. That should never be our point of view in this country. This is a country where we truly believe that every person has potential, that it doesn't matter how you start. It doesn't matter where you come from. It doesn't matter how much money you have. What matters is you have potential. And education is the single most powerful tool to help people fulfill their potential. And we are failing our children. So here again, I think we cannot be serious about growing our economy or competing in the 21st century unless we get serious about truly fundamental educational reform that starts with the basic, which is every child must have a good teacher. And clearly many children do not. We of course need fundamental immigration reform. This is a country that was built by immigrants. We have to have comprehensive immigration reform, not just because we need more high-skilled workers, which is, of course, a thing that Silicon Valley companies are very focused on, but because you never know who is going to have the most potential. It could be the migrant farm worker's daughter who turns out to make a huge difference to her community. I think we have a chance of getting comprehensive immigration reform passed this time around. I hope so very much. But I also think that if either party tries to push it too far one way or the other, that that very delicate compromise might fall apart. But we must have a legal immigration system that works. We must deal with, in an appropriate and respectful way, the people who are already here. And we must never forget that people come here for one reason: to build a better life for themselves and their families. And this nation has been made great because people took the risk to come here to work hard for a better life. So I think we need fundamental tax and regulatory reform with a focus on the small business owner and the entrepreneur instead of a focus on the big company. I think we need fundamental education reform that remembers that the most important thing is not the size of the budget of the Department of Education, but the quality of the teacher in the classroom. I think we need fundamental immigration reform that recognizes that we must welcome anyone who is willing to come here and work hard to build a better life, because that is our vitality and our future, as it always has been. And finally, I think we need fundamental innovation reform. And what I mean by that is the following. Look, this is a country that has always led in innovation. And that is why we have led economically. This is now the century of brain power and innovation. The country with the best brain power wins. The country with the best ideas wins. That is how this century will play out. There are, I think, four industries that are going to define this century, and we should be leading in innovation in every single one of them. Certainly, information technology, including social networking, and we're doing really well there. Energy, biotech, and health tech. And I actually think aerospace and space technology, because if you look at the kinds of innovations that have come from an aerospace program, they're very fundamental and significant in our economy. Those four industries, I think, will define our century, and we must lead in innovation in every single one of them. Now, why do I say fundamental innovation reform? Because, in truth, our government, in my humble opinion, is not playing the right role right now, and it hasn't been for some time. Again, this isn't a partisan comment. Government's most productive role, I believe, in innovation is to invest in basic research and platform innovation. Things that government, only government, has the resources to do, or perhaps government in conjunction with academia as an example. You all, of course, know the story of how the internet was actually invented. It came out of something called DARPA. Only the government had the resources to actually invest in that kind of platform capability. The space program, which only the government at that time had the resources to invest in, has produced scores of technologies which have helped us lead and have made our lives better. What the government, in my humble opinion, cannot do is play venture capitalist. We've got a lot of great venture capitalists around here. We don't need more in Washington, D.C. Government is bad at determining winners and losers. What government should be doing is investing in these basic research and these basic platform capabilities and creating the environment in which innovators can prosper. Creating the environment in which people say, wow, I'm being encouraged to take a risk. I'm being encouraged to take a chance. I'm going to close my comments here so we can start with your questions. But let me just end by going back to where I started. This is a time in human history driven by technology where, as we all know, the pace of change is accelerating, where institutions with centralized hierarchical decision making are increasingly unable to keep pace, where individuals are empowered, and where brain power and ideas are going to define winners. And that is why I believe we need to look at the structural issues we have in our economy now and rethink in a fairly fundamental way. I recognize that that's very difficult to do. I particularly recognize that it is very difficult for our current political institutions and our current political processes to wrestle with big issues that are complicated. And yet I think it is what's required. And without some of these fundamental reforms, I think our economy is going to continue to perform at way under its potential. And we're going to continue to have too many people in this country who are not getting a shot at the American dream. I remain always optimistic because I think this is the most incredible era in human history ever. The truth is more things are more possible for more people in more places than ever before in history. But people stay ahead, companies stay ahead, and nations stay ahead by recognizing that sometimes you have to fundamentally relook at not our core values, not the things that have made us great, but what we need to do to continue to compete in a world that will always continue to change. Thank you very much, and I will look forward now to your questions.
Thank you, Carly, for your insights and ideas. We have a lot to discuss, a lot of questions here. I'd like to start by your comment that we need to create a risk-free environment for entrepreneurs. What specifically do you feel the government can do to create a risk-free environment?
Well, actually, I don't think we should create a risk-free environment. I don't think such a thing exists. I think if I said that, I misspoke. What I believe is that we need to create an environment in which people feel free to take risks, which is a very different thing. Think about what a small business owner or an entrepreneur actually has to do to create something from nothing, which is what entrepreneurs do. They have to be willing to put everything on the line. I don't care whether you're opening a new deli down the street or you're going to build the next great technology company in your garage, you're risking everything. And so you want an environment that will encourage that risk-taking. So what do I think the government can do? One, I think the government, as I said, needs to vastly simplify the tax code that small business and entrepreneurs have to deal with. not every entrepreneur is going to become a billionaire. You know, that's not, that happens here. But there are a lot of places in the country where that doesn't happen. Vastly simplify the tax code. I think we need literally, you know, if I were queen for a day, I would establish a group of bipartisan entrepreneurs. I would send them to Washington for a year, and I would ask them to look at absolutely every regulation on the book. And I would ask them to evaluate what are those that are getting in their way. I think we would find probably, this is a guess on my part, but I just know what happens with creep over time. My guess is we would find 80% of the stuff that's out there getting in people's way is actually not helping us accomplish objectives. But we need a way to clear out the thicket now.
Makes sense. So if you were queen for the day, what would you do to encourage corporations to get involved in education, especially encouraging our kids in America in STEM subjects?
Yes. So this is actually a subject near and dear to my heart. I wrote a thesis on this when I was at MIT. Corporations can play a very important role. They can play an important role, for example, by providing kids in STEM disciplines with a vision of what their future might be like. So as an example, Hewlett-Packard, I presume, still has, certainly they did while I was there, a program where we would go into disadvantaged neighborhoods. We would find kids in schools that were interested in the STEM disciplines, and then we would give those kids mentors and opportunities so that they could see, oh, this is the kind of life I might have. This is the kind of job I might have. These are the kinds of people that are engaged in this area. One of the things we know is that particularly in disadvantaged communities, kids give up. It's too hard. And so they need encouragement. That's one thing that corporations can do. Certainly, when corporations set up internships and bring kids out of college and give them an opportunity to work in the summer, that makes a huge difference. If companies are and their employees are engaged in communities, helping to fund charter schools, for example, to give people choices, I think all that is wonderful. The reason I stress in my comments just now disadvantaged neighborhoods, if the 21st century is the century of brain power, and we are a nation of 300 million people, and we are competing against countries like China with a billion people, we cannot afford to lose a single child. We don't have the luxury of saying, you know what, we'll just hope that these highly educated people who get a degree here will stay here, or we'll just focus on places where communities with greater advantages. We need every child to have a chance in this country.
Good. So we have a number of audience questions about HP, of course. And first question is, what was the biggest lesson you learned while at HP and in the HP aftermath? Is there one lesson?
No. I was very privileged to serve as chairman and CEO of Hewlett-Packard for 6 years. I'm immensely proud of my time there and all of the incredible work that HP employees did. You can't boil that down to one lesson. I will say this. I think that, and I've said this publicly on many occasions, I've had the privilege to serve on many different boards and many different kinds of boards. And I have said publicly that I think boards remain one of the least transparent and least accountable institutions in the country today. And boards must be more accountable and more transparent, because boards are accountable for a lot of value. Now, I'm not making a veiled comment about anything. It's just, it's a fact. And
but you find that on the HP board.
I'm talking about boards in general. Let me take it out of HP, for example. Remember Enron? Tens of thousands of employees lost their jobs, in large measure because Enron board members, each of them very talented individuals, decided to waive the code of ethics so that Enron could engage in a set of investments that brought the company down. It is no wonder that people get a little cynical when the whole company was destroyed, a bunch of accounting firms went down as well, and there is no accountability for those board members. Or another example, Kodak, a great American company that is no more. And through that long demise, not a single board member changed. Something's wrong with that.
What is your definition of the HP way, and how do you respond to critics who claim that the abandonment of the founder's values and the HP way began when you joined the company?
You know, I honestly didn't come here to do a postmortem on HP, which, I left.
We have lots of other questions.
In 2005. The HP way has always been about innovation, entrepreneurship, standards of ethics. I don't think those things were abandoned when I was there. I think they were reinforced. But everyone is entitled to their opinion.
And do you still follow the company closely as an outsider to HP? And do you have any advice for Meg Whitman?
I have friends there. I'm a shareholder. And my advice isn't particularly helpful right now, I think.
Okay. So let's move on and talk about Sheryl Sandberg's book. Everyone seems to be talking about Sheryl Sandberg's book, Lean In. It's not just a book, but a movement. She says, one of her theses is, sisters are doing it to ourselves. Women need to lean in more to big challenges. Do you agree with that? And how should they be leaning in more, if you do agree?
Well, I think first, isn't it wonderful that Sheryl is using her time and her talent to try and lift women up and inspire them? I mean, that's a wonderful thing. I agree that there are times when women will, for example, be reluctant to try something new, to take on a new challenge. It's also true, however, that men sometimes will not take a risk and hire a woman. And I think the fundamental here is that too many women don't have choices. They don't have options. If you're a single mom trying to raise two kids and you're one of those subsistence level people in the Bay Area that I was talking about, you probably don't feel like you can take a lot of risk. Women, let's take it out of a gender context. Women are the most underutilized resource in the world and in this country. That's just an economic fact. 1 in 6 people live in poverty in this country. That burden falls most heavily on women and their children. Of the people around the world who live on less than $2 a day, 70% of them are women. It is a fact that with all of the problems we have in the world, whether it's war, disease, poverty, illiteracy, the data is crystal clear. If you get women engaged, the problem gets solved faster. One of the things that's going on in Africa today is called the feminization of agriculture. It turns out that if you teach a woman how to be a farmer, food production goes up. I happen to have started something called the One Woman Initiative five or so years ago. I've now partnered with Opportunity International, which is the largest micro-lending organization in the world. I'm sure many of you are familiar with microfinance, the loaning of very small amounts of money to help people get started. Muhammad Yunus, the founder of microfinance, started out by lending to men because that's what he assumed he should do. Men were the people who you invested in. What he found out was that men were not very good credit risks in many of these parts of the world. They didn't invest money well. And so he started investing in women. Opportunity International, 98% of our recipients are women. The repayment rate by women is huge. Why? Because women invest in their children. They invest in their communities. Conflict resolution. Virtually every conflict around the world, people figure out if you get women engaged in that situation, it gets better. So to me, the issue is how do we make sure that in a time of great challenge here and around the world, that we more effectively leverage the most underutilized resource out there, which is women. The data is clear. When you get them involved, things get better.
Can you comment on Marissa Meyer's recent edict for Yahoo, no one shall work from home? Some are calling it disdainful of working mothers.
So first I would say that I think it is a shame that any time a woman does something, whether you like it or dislike it, it gets put into the context of gender. It is a shame that despite all the progress that has been made, women as leaders are still subjected to greater levels of scrutiny and criticism than are men. It's just a fact. Whether you agree or disagree with Marissa Meyer's decision, it is true that when Marissa Meyer made that announcement, all hell broke loose proverbially. A week later, the male CEO of Best Buy made exactly the same decision, and there was virtually no discussion. Now, Marissa Meyer is a CEO making a decision about her company. It is her right to do that. In my own experience, there are some things that simply require face-to-face interaction and flexibility, and the tools that provide flexibility are most helpful to women.
Thoughts on the resurgence of feminism, and do you consider yourself a feminist?
Well, I think it's funny. Feminism, feminist, it's a word that has so many connotations for so many different people. Here's what I think it is. I think people should have the tools and the opportunities to live the life they choose. And when a woman can live the life she chooses, when she has the tools, which include education, the opportunities, which means a job, when she has the tools and the opportunities to make her own choices and to live the life she wants, then, to me, that is liberation. I don't intend to prescribe to other women what kind of life they should choose to live.
But you want them to have choices.
But I want them to have a choice. And far too few women have choices.
Good point. And you have experienced this intense scrutiny yourself at HP and presumably before that at Lucent.
And after,
of course. Talk about, not just for women, for all of us here, dealing with criticism. How do you deal with it on a personal level and on a business or political level?
How do you process it and move on from it?
Well, I think first, if anyone who is in a position to be driving change, which is what leadership is, people are going to comment. And a lot of the commentary is going to be negative. It's just the nature of life. So let me just quickly say, what is leadership? Management is the production of acceptable results within known constraints and conditions. Management's very important, but management is the production of acceptable results within known constraints and conditions. Leadership is about changing the order of things. Leadership is about changing the constraints and conditions. Leadership is about making a positive difference. So when you are leading, you are changing things, and when you change things, not everyone's going to be happy. I am fond of saying that change is like heaven. Everyone wants to go there. Nobody wants to die. Which means, in theory, everyone says, let's change. But in practice, what a lot of people believe is, and you mean they're going to change. Not me. They're going to change. Change is hard. So if you're leading, people will criticize. You just have to know that walking in. Secondly, if you are different, people will criticize more. If you're the first, people will criticize even more. It is the nature of things. So a little bit of this goes with the territory. I think as well, it's important to be able to separate the wheat from the chaff, meaning there is some scrutiny and criticism that you need to pay attention to because it's meaningful. It's valid. It's something you need to adjust to or learn from.
And how do you decide what is valid?
And a lot of it's not.
And how do you decide?
Well, that's called judgment, isn't it?
Right.
It's called judgment. It's called perspective. It's called wisdom. And there is no formula for that, and there is no magic bullet.
And is developing a thick skin part of it?
Of course. Of course. Because otherwise, especially in this era of always on, you know, people are tweeting, and it's remarkable what people will say in cyberspace. They are rude and cruel in a way I don't think most people would be face to face.
Because a lot of it's anonymous, right?
Or they think it is. And so if you fixate on that, honestly, you'd go pull the covers up over your head and never come out.
So you just move on.
You have to keep it in perspective.
Right. So talking of change, you have transformed from business executive to politician or political advisor. What skills transfer and what skills did you ditch? Any you ditched?
Well, I think business is about people and politics is about people. I mean, everything's about people, actually. But, you know, so the ability to set goals, and now, by the way, I chair several not-for-profits. It's true in the philanthropic world as well. The ability to set goals, the ability to communicate clearly a vision. All of those things are important in any walk of life, whether you're, you know, dealing with your family, dealing with a business, dealing with politics. Some of these skills are just human if you want to be successful or drive change in a positive direction. On the other hand, business decision making is founded on a common set of metrics or rules. There's sort of a scorecard in business. You know, the scorecard has to do with what's the income statement and the balance sheet look like. The scorecard has to do with, for example, people track patents, or, you know, there are facts that people tend to recognize as and agree on as important indicators. In politics, what I found is facts are frequently irrelevant. A lot of politicians on both sides of the aisle make up facts.
Do you think
literally.
That's a recent phenomenon?
No,
or do you think
I do not. I think, but I think it is exacerbated in this era where people are more focused on slogans than solutions. I think it is a very big problem that we are reducing our political discourse to 140 character tweets.
So you don't tweet?
I don't think it's particularly helpful. And by the way, I mean, people on both sides of the aisle are tweeting, but when we have presidents and majority leaders and politicians who are tweeting all the time, and 140 characters becomes the news bite, that is not substantive political discourse.
Agreed.
That's sloganeering. And I think a lot of our political process has come down to contention for contention's sake, sloganeering. It is frequently a fact-free zone. I think the only way to fix that, honestly, is for citizens to be involved, stay involved, and demand something different. It's why I got involved in politics. I think you can't say, I hate the political process and not do anything to try and make it better.
Are you optimistic about the future of the Republican Party? What do you think it needs to do to get its groove back?
Well, I think the Republican Party needs to stop talking about the future of the Republican Party, because I think most people don't care about the future of a party. I mean, I think most people care about the future of their job, the future of their family, the future of their community. I don't think most people care about the future of a party. So I think people who, whatever party they're in, people need to focus on solutions to problems that will work for people. And that's what we need to be talking about. And I think we talk too little about it.
Right. Question, can you comment on gay marriage? It's a big political issue right now, going to the Supreme Court next week.
Well, look, I think that there are certain issues that are highly contentious and deeply personal. I believe those kinds of issues, and I would put gay marriage in this category, should be resolved through the democratic process. And what I mean by that is let people vote on these things. Let people vote over and over again if necessary. Let people vote in the states. This is a classic example of where I think decentralized and democratic decision making makes sense. But I think when you have judges deciding what cultural mores should be, I think somehow you're going to have people unhappy with that decision. We have the technology in place today to vote effectively on virtually everything. I mean, people are voting on American Idol every week. You know, we could vote on many things. And gay marriage is one of the things I think we should vote on.
Right. You talked in your comments about certain areas that you feel America is going to be a future leader. For example, space.
Well, I hope so. It's not clear to me we will be.
Can you name particular entrepreneurs or companies that you see a lot of future for?
Well, so let me be clear about what I'm saying. I think there are four industries that will define the 21st century. Information technology in all its forms, health and biotechnology, space technology, energy technology. I think right now, frankly, we are leading in one out of four. So I applaud in aerospace and the space industry. I applaud what's going on with SpaceX. I applaud when you have entrepreneurs like Eric Schmidt and others really investing heavily in space technology. I also am concerned that if you look at, I talked about what I thought was the rightful role of government in innovation. I am concerned when we have the Chinese government investing heavily, the Russian government investing heavily, my goodness, the Brazilian government investing heavily, the Japanese government investing heavily in space technology, and our government is stepping further and further back. I think that's a problem.
All right. I have a question from the audience, or a comment. I saw you on This Week with George Stephanopoulos. You were great. So what is next for you?
Well, time will tell. You know, my life now is varied and interesting and fulfilling and fun. I am very engaged, as I mentioned briefly, in two philanthropic efforts. One is around lifting women out of poverty around the world through the tool of microfinance. And the second is I chair what is the largest product philanthropy organization in the world. And we are focused very much on women because the burden of poverty rests most heavily with women. Good 360 is a fantastic organization. What we do is take excess inventory from companies, of which there is a lot, and instead of that excess inventory ending up in a landfill, we distribute it to 36,000 charities in this country. Imagine this happens every day. Instead of a package of diapers going into the landfill, it goes to a poor woman who's trying to take care of her family. So that work is very fulfilling. I enjoy the political commentary. I continue to be engaged in business. I'm pretty engaged in a number of policy initiatives in Washington, D.C., with something called the Center for Strategic and International Studies, which is, in my judgment, the only bipartisan think tank left in Washington, D.C. And I think that problems don't get solved without bipartisan cooperation. As I said, I think our political discourse is way too contentious and way too polarized right now. So life is pretty good right now. And I've never had a game plan for my life, but I have been presented with many interesting opportunities, and I tend to recognize opportunities when they come along.
Great. Let's talk about climate change. Do you believe the government has a role to play in curbing climate change?
Yes, but I also think we need to be realistic about the facts around climate change. And here are the facts. Every scientist agrees that no nation acting alone will have any impact on climate change. Every scientist also agrees that to impact climate change will require an effort worth trillions of dollars over many decades. So, based on those facts, I personally think AB 32 in California is misguided, because what it does is put a huge burden on businesses in this state, and the outcome will not positively affect our climate. In my judgment, the most important and effective thing that the U.S. government could do is begin now a substantive, long-range conversation with the nation of China about what the U.S. and China together are willing to do to make an impact on this problem. Because unless and until China is engaged in this, we cannot make an impact. China and the U.S. together are responsible for over 50% of the pollution in the world. A third of the particulate matter in California comes from China. I mean, we just have to deal with some facts. So it may make us feel good to say the U.S. are going to lead the way with climate regulation, but in fact it won't solve the problem. You see, I think too much of our political process is focused on political gesture instead of problem solving. Let me make a gesture to win a vote. but it won't solve the problem.
We've reached the point in our program, there's time for just one last question, and the question is from the audience. If you could tell your 20-year-old self any piece of advice, what would it be?
That's a heck of a last question.
It's going to have to be pithy. No pressure.
Life is a great adventure. Enjoy it. The things that you worry about turn out not to be the things, perhaps, that you should have worried about. The toughest times in life sometimes turn out to be the greatest blessings. And we are in control of very little. But we do control our own choices.
That's excellent. I hope you've enjoyed this evening's program brought to you by the Commonwealth Club Silicon Valley. We would like to thank Carly Fiorina, who is wonderful, former CEO of HP and chair of Good 360, our audience here in Palo Alto, and all of you joining us on the radio. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club is adjourned.